Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hi, and welcome to Lob Podcast from These Football Times. In this mini-series called Icons, a number of the team from TFT Towers will be chatting about players, recent or past, who they consider worthy of being described as true icons of the football world. My name is Gary Thacker, and in this episode I'm chatting with the technical wizard of TFT, Dave Bowler, about one of his footballing icons. Hi, Dave.
Good to speak to you again, Gary.
Indeed so, mate. I always like chatting about football. Lovely. I got myself a cup of coffee, and it's a Saturday morning. It's sunshine, I know, in here. In the UK, perhaps not so good, but there we go. Tell us who your icon is we're going to talk about now.
From the sunshine land of Italy, it's Andrea Pirlo.
Okay, that's good. Okay, so before we delve into a little bit of detail, what makes Pirlo an icon?
All kinds of things, I think. I mean, you'll like this, Gary, in particular. Johan Cruyff. Pirlo can make his foot do whatever he wants. He's a genius. Now, who am I to disagree with Johan Cruyff? Or who is anybody to disagree with Johan Cruyff?
I'm not going to do it, that's for sure, bro.
I think, you know, over the sort of the first 20 years of the 21st century, I think nobody was a more elegant figure on the football pitch than Pirlo. He's one of those players who, you know, when you're watching the game on television, you can always see what the right pass is because you've got the whole thing out in front of you. Most of the time, you know, players don't make the right pass because, you know, they're stuck in amongst the legs and the muck and bullets. And not only did Pirlo make the right pass virtually every time, like Zidane, I suppose, you know, 10 years earlier, he made the pass that you didn't even know was the right pass before he made it. And that, I think, was his genius. He could see passes and angles and movements before anybody else could see them. He got no particular pace, no great stamina, wasn't a great tackler. But as soon as the ball was at his feet, he was one of those players where the stadium would hold its breath because they knew something was going to happen. And it was going to happen in a perfect Italian suit kind of a way. You know? it was all that. I'm amazed I've got in here before Stephen Scragg, frankly, because, I mean, this is the hipster choice. But yeah, I mean, everything about cool and elegance and beauty and all of that kind of stuff, that's what the way Pirlo was played, I think.
I love that metaphor. It was like playing, you can imagine him playing in a finely cut Italian suit with lines. And he's not going to get it dirty, is he? He's not going to get it dirty. He's going to stay calm. You know, I mean, I guess, you know, so look at, you mentioned the sort of early years of the sort of the century and when he was in his prime. And I guess, you know, people look at Italian football and they think, you know, they might think of people like, you know, Gentile or that sort of thing, you know, who was probably the least genteel player in the world. And, you know, the hard-knock defenders or the sort of nippy little forwards. But he was none of that, was he, really? In the era where the Italian football stars were either the guys who were going to pilfer the goals or kick somebody up in there. In this era, he was a sort of different type of Italian player, wasn't he? You mentioned Zidane. I guess I can see the link there as well.
Yeah, just graceful, intelligent, thoughtful. I mean, I suppose in some senses, he was more a Spanish player than an Italian player from that kind of era. You could see him, you know, fitting in that Barcelona team or the Spanish team that won the World Cup and the Euros. He was that kind of a player. It's such a lazy thing to say, but I'm going to say it anyway. I mean, he was like playing chess, you know, that kind of a footballer, I think. It's, you know, he was the one that could see the moves that were coming and he could manipulate people around to get into the places that he wanted him to be in, which is a remarkable skill. He was kind of the, again, an obvious one, but he was conducting the orchestra in that sense. And, you know, interestingly, he didn't start off in that position. I mean, he became the epitome of the deep-lying playmaker, playing just in front of the defence. But I mean, he started further up the pitch. He was a number 10 and stuff. And it wasn't until he went to Brescia on loan, having started there, then moved to Inter, he went back to Brescia on loan. And that was when he started playing. He was an attacking midfielder before that. But I think that move unlocked everything because he, as I say, he hadn't got that pace. So playing higher up the pitch, you've got to have that bit of acceleration or that bit of something about you. I mean, you know, that bit of speed. But playing deeper with everything in front of him, and you know, you can see all the pictures from there, and that range of passing, a Glenn Hoddle type range of passing for, you know, that sort of thing. You know, 40, 50 yards, drop it exactly where you want it to, or play it shorter. All of those things. I mean, it's not revolutionising the game, but it's playing that position as well as anybody's ever played it, I think.
Definitely, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting to say about players who haven't got a lot of pace that, you know, they say the first 5 yards is in the head. Well, for Perlow, the first 5 seconds ahead of anybody else was in his head. As you say, he could see things before other people could, and gave him that ability to play that deep line role. One of those, you want a dog in midfield playing alongside him. Get the ball, give it to Perlow and shut up. Let him play. And he'll you know, it will open defences up because, you know, that was his stock in trade. Okay, so a little sort of round-up discussion about him. So are there any sort of define? And I guess, you know, for English support, English fans or British fans listening in, who aren't sort of familiar with Italian football so much, certainly of that era perhaps, are there any sort of defining matches or seasons where his ability sort of shone through?
I mean, one of the great things is the longevity. I think for 10 years he was at that kind of level. But I think the one that the people in this country above all will remember is the 2006 World Cup, which for me, he was the player of the competition. I thought he was absolutely outstanding through that whole competition. Yeah, you know, and you got to remember, Italian football at that point was going through all the chaos of the bribery and all of that, and nobody knew who was still going to be in Serie A the following season, and what was going to happen to Milan, what was going to happen to Juventus, and what was going to, all of that. So there's a lot of chaos going on, and he's the sort of the calm in the middle of the storm, really. And the semi-final against Germany, I think, is one of my favourite games of all time. It was a fabulous game of football. Yeah, it wasn't necessarily the crash-bang wallop of this is West Germany, against Italy in 1970. You know, I mean, that was an epic in a different way. But this was just such a great game of football, and he was running the show really all the way through. And he's the one that, you know, in the finish, unlocked the game. He played a pass through for Grosso to score the first goal. And he said, you know, when you play with Andrea, you always have to expect the pass that nobody else can see. When he's not looking, that's when you're going to get the pass. And that was how that pass was. But that was how it was all the way through the game. And I mean, a few years later, because I've always followed Juventus from getting a football annual when I was about 5, and they were in black and white. It was in black and white, and they were wearing the same kit as the Albion. I thought, this lot must be all right. And,
Dave, yeah, how disillusioned you must have been afterwards.
a good friend of mine, Simon Miotto, who was a goalkeeper at the Albion, an Italian-Australian, big Juventus fan, and I went over with him to see Juventus 2 or 3 times in Turin. And the thing about Pirlo is, if he ever gave the ball away, and I think he gave it away twice in 3 games, the stadium actually gasped. The stadium actually was like, how did that happen? What happened there? This isn't right. There must have been an earthquake or something. And that's that kind of control that he had of the ball and of everyone around him, you know. It's not quite a midfield general in that sense, but very much the one setting the tone for everything. And I think that 2006 World Cup was a perfect example of that. But I think the other one that English supporters will remember is the Euros in 2012, when he basically finished Joe Hart.
He did.
And, you know, you kind of forget now. I was looking in preparation for this, but Italy were 2-1 down after 2 penalties. They'd missed a penalty, and he's taking the third one. Now, if that one doesn't go in, England probably win. But so he's got to level it up, and he sends this Panenka down the middle, and Joe Hart is never the same footballer ever again after that. England fall apart, and Italy eventually advance to the finals and lose to Spain. But that presence of mind, that calm, that temperament in that moment, with, you know, the whole of Europe watching, and you know the Italians much as they love their players, they're not short on giving them a bit of stick if they've done the wrong thing either. So you know that if you go back to Italy having tried a Panenka and you've just dropped it into Joe Hart's hands and lost the game, you're coming for a bit of stick. So to do that in extremis, again, that is just the mark of somebody who is a cut above.
We've used a few words to sort of describe Perlo and his sort of play on the pitch, and elegant and calm and cool. And a few months ago, probably 12 months ago now, we produced a Liverpool magazine, and I wrote a piece on Xabi Alonso. I mean, I always liked Xabi Alonso. I think he was not of Perlo's, but that's sort of a similar sort of approach to the game. And I said, I just described it. It was like he was listening to a Rodrigo guitar concerto in his ear, and everybody else would listen to thrash metal. That was the difference between the sort of sereneness almost of the play. And Perlo had that in spades, didn't he?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, he said before the World Cup final, you know, people said, he was asked afterwards, well, did you feel the pressure? Did you feel the nerves? He said, no, I didn't give a toss, really. I spent the afternoon resting and playing PlayStation, and then in the evening I went and won the World Cup.
it's just the sort of Sunday we all have, isn't it, really, in fairness? I guess this is an interesting thing to ponder, and I guess, did he redefine his position in the play, or almost did he define it rather than refine it? That sort of player, as you said, converted from being the sort of number 10 to more like a number 4, sitting in front of the back, but not as a sort of shield, as the guy with the space to be creative.
I've been thinking about this the last couple of days to try and work out exactly what, because I mean, there have been deep lying playmakers before and all of that. I think what he did was he still played as a number 10, but he did it 50 yards further back, because with the passing ability that he'd got, he was still able to unlock any defences from there. He didn't have to be in and around the 18 yard box. He could be on the halfway line and do it, you know. And obviously, of course, he got further forward. He scored goals and was a great free kick taker and all of that. But I think with that vision and that ability to spot not just the run, but the moment. Football's all about rhythm. It's the ebbs and the flows, and it's spotting, you know, that moment in the music where, you know, you want to play the solo or you want to change chord or whatever it is, and that was the thing that he got. You know, he got that footballing intellect to spot that was the moment, and that's very, very few players have got that. You know, I mean, you are again talking about the great playmakers, the Zidane's, that level of player. He could see it, and you know, again, another quote, Ancelotti said that Pirlo could see in a split second a pass that most players wouldn't see in a lifetime. And that, you know, that absolutely is what he could do. And there have been number fours. I mean, I don't know what this number four business is, to be honest with you. Me and you, Gary, from a different world.
I was trying to ingratiate myself with the kids.
Yeah, you know, people have played that position before, haven't they? But as I say, I think he sort of remodeled it a bit into being a number 10. All that way back, just because of the ability that he got, and also if you play that far back, you give yourself that little bit more room, you give yourself that little bit more time than if you are playing just off the striker. Obviously, it's a bit more congested. Give him that little bit of room, and you know, he could take anybody apart.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's a good way to describe it. Number 10 playing in the number 4 role, because whereas a number 10 can reach a defence with a 5-yard pass, Perlo could do it with a 50-yard pass. And of course, playing further back, obviously he had more space to sort of, you know, be creative and have that time. I guess, you know, this is an interesting one to consider. Any contract, you mentioned about the sort of the bribery issues that were going around and match fixing at the time. So any sort of controversies or setbacks that affected him, and how did he handle them?
I suppose, you know, the big setback was early on in his career when he went to Inter and never made it through, never really got into the Inter team, two loan spells, you know, right at the early stage of his career. And God, Inter must be ruining that now, particularly given that they then sold him to to Milan, and he went and played three European Cup finals for them within, you know, about 4 or 5 years. I think, you know, in terms of setbacks, it's always self-belief. You know, I think arrogance is probably a too strong a word, because I don't think there was ever much arrogance about his play. You know, I think for all the brilliance of it, I think, you know, there was a sort of humility about his football. He was in the service of the team rather than in the service of Pirlo. So, yeah, that I think is an important one. And there are people that, you know, will get talked about in this Icon series who are more about them than the team. And, you know, they've been hugely successful as a result, and their teams have benefited from that. But I think, you know, and Lippi has got a big part to play in that, because I think in 2006 it was all about the team. Italy were the best team in that World Cup, as well as having great players. They were the best team. And Pirlo, I think, probably was central to that, but I think he learned from it as well. So, you know, I think self-belief is how he dealt with any sort of setbacks, you know. And there were, you know, obviously that, again, I still can't believe Stephen Stragg's not talking about this, but that Istanbul, obviously, you know, he said, you know, after that, he was thinking of packing it up. He was thinking of just saying, no, I can't do this anymore, I'm going to retire. But ultimately came back and then won another Champions League against Liverpool with Milan. So, you know, redemption, I suppose, in a sense, in that way. So I think it's believing in what you do. That's the way he sort of came back from it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I guess a lot of the players we're going to talk about in this series are going to be sort of discussing this series. I've had a larger-than-life off-the-field character, shall we say, in many sort of times. But I guess with Pirlo, it didn't so much, did he? I mean, you never heard of Pirlo being involved in a nightclub fight, and you can't imagine it happening. I mean, you can imagine going out to a nice restaurant and having a nice meal with his missus or his family or whatever, and you can imagine him I can imagine Pirlo going to the opera. I don't know if he did, and that, you know, he's just got cultured appearance, that sort of aura about him, and his sort of non persona off the field only sort of feeds into that, didn't it?
Absolutely. He owns a vineyard, so, you know.
Oh, there you go. You see, I didn't know that, but straight down the middle of the fairway. Well done, Gary.
I mean, I read his book, the translation of his book.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know, got about 10 years ago now. And the book's called I Think, Therefore I Play.
That's right, yeah.
And, you know, I mean, that sums everything up, doesn't it, really? And that is one of the great elements of football. Not all of my favourite footballers are like that. But, you know, people like him, like Zidane, like Cruyff, a lot of it, happens in the brain as happens in the feet, you know, and you know, I find that really interesting and absorbing to watch. And yeah, there are other players where it is all about the feet, you know. That's spectacular. And there's nothing wrong with that. But you know, I'm by and large drawn to those players like that. So I think, therefore, I play. I mean, that's like a motto for life, isn't it, really? You know,
I can't imagine there's many footballers' autobiography where they've sort of lifted the title from a René Descartes statement.
But yeah, I mean, yeah, we should all get rid of all the mottos in at the bottom of all the football badges and shove that in. I think they've all had
that. Yeah. Okay. So and because he's off the field. Image is so sort of unusually quiet, shall we say. Let's say, did he influence football world beyond the pitch? But I guess perhaps the attitude he had and the sort of ethos he had about playing might have. But as I say, you don't really imagine him being a big personality, you know, not particularly massively outgoing, not particularly seeking the paparazzi.
I think it was Conte who said, you know, Juventus, when he went to Juventus later on, that he leads with his feet. You know, he's not one of those in the dressing room who's shouting and screaming and, you know, leading that way by tub thumping. He leads by example. And I think it's a very difficult thing to quantify. I think he's one of those people who is a footballer's footballer, if you like. He's one of those ones who, yeah, I mean, you're right. I think he's hugely underestimated over the last 10 years. And I think people don't talk about him a great deal now that he's finished. And, you know, I think he was in the top 10 of the Ballon d'Or 3 times. How did he not win it? You know, never mind only being in the top 10 3 times. I mean, who the hell was in the top 10 the other 10 years? But you're right, and particularly, you know, more and more in the social media age and the age that we're in now, you have to claim attention, don't you? You have to go out and get it. Yes. There's so much, you know, that, you know, me and you grew up in an era of 2 and 3 TV channels and no foreign football and all of that. Now you're bombarded with it from every possible angle. You've got Blue Sky, you've got X, you've got Facebook, you've got Instagram, you've got TikTok, you've got God knows what else. And if you're not on all of them, you just don't get the, you know, you're not part of the story, so maybe not part of the conversation. And so I think in that sense he's been a little bit forgotten, which is scandalous, really. And yeah, his managerial time hasn't worked out thus far. You know, Juventus and Sampdoria, it's not gone particularly well. So, you know, that kind of chips away at your general reputation a little bit. But I think, you know, he's going to be one of those that when people write learned books and magazine articles, he'll be one of those that comes to the fore again and again, I think, because, you know, people will dig in and say, yeah, this is the fellow that made that work.
It's fascinating. Just something that came to mind when you were saying that. Is he the kind of player that will be more appreciated in 50 years' time than he is 5 or 6 years after he, well, perhaps 10 years after he finished? When there's time for people's attitude to mature about the sort of things he achieved.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think, you know, as I say, with modern culture as it is, everything goes so quick. And so, you know, the stuff that happened yesterday is of no value to anybody because we're looking at what's happening tomorrow because things move on so fast. And it's only when you're looking at when the documentaries are made or the books are written or the, you know, that kind of stuff, and you're taking a look at it back from this perspective, that the people will see it. And I think that's the great advantage he's got compared to, I don't know, Bobby Charlton, for instance, or Puskas or Di Stefano, or, you know, because they weren't on television very much, and there's not a huge, I mean, not even Bobby Charlton was on television that much. There's not a huge amount of them to look at, you know. We've seen all the clips that there are of Puskas to see. There's about 8 of them or 10 of them, and that's it. Whereas, you know, at least you would imagine that on YouTube, you'll be able to go back and watch as many Pirlo games as you like in the future, and they'll still be there. And not just him, but, you know, his generation and you know, the Ronaldo generation and all that, they'll be there. They'll be there forever for people to come and look at. So I think that'll be, I think you're right. I think when, you know, we it won't be me and you, but in 50 years' time, when people come looking back, I think that, you know, that I think he will. I think he will get the sort of credit that perhaps he deserves.
Yeah. Okay. So a final thing to consider, and I always like this sort of question. You know, it's one of these things where you can ponder and think, you know, and there's no right answer. I think there is, and I think we'll probably agree on it as well. How would Pirlo, I mean, we're not talking about, you know, a guy who played 50 years ago, but, you know, how would he fit in the game's move on so quickly, as you said? How would Pirlo fit into the modern game?
I think, as I say, it's only, what, 10 years since he packed up, so, I mean, it's, although the game has changed, it's not changed that much. I think he would, to me, a lot of the time, the game is crying out for somebody like that. Because, you know, regular listeners will know, I have not a lot of patience with a lot of what's happening in football. This business of the pass between the centre halves, yeah, great. Yeah, the centre halves now have more passes than anybody else in the team. What's the bloody use of that? Because frankly, if you're a centre half, you can't pass, because that's why you're playing centre half. So to me, it's screaming out for the goalkeeper not to be playing it to the two centre halves who are standing in the penalty box waiting for the goalkeeper. Play to Pirlo, and then somebody who's got the ball can do something with it. You know, I think playing through the thirds and all of that is there's a lot to be said for it. And, you know, we both remember when football never saw the middle third from one goalkeeper to the other, basically.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot to commend what's gone on in the game, but give it to the fellas who can use it. For me, now, don't give it the centre half. Give it to the bloke like Pirlo who can play the 60-yard pass, the Glenn Hoddle, the Zidane. You know,
I guess the problem with that is there ain't that many Pirlos about these days, are there? I mean, I think, you know, how would you fit into the modern game? I think with typical grace and elegance, I think would probably
absolutely.
You know, I mean, yeah, I mean, if you had a guy like that playing in front of you back four, the deep lying midfielder, creative midfielder, all right, you want to roll to the centre, then give it to Pirlo. Although the odds are the opposition's going to know and they're going to be man marking him. But yeah, I think players like that, especially in this era, as you say, when sort of playing through the press, as it were, is quite voguish. You know, a guy who can split a defence from 50 or 60 yards. I mean, Jesus. I mean, can you imagine him playing in City, you know, for City? I mean, there's a bit of a massive issue that'll go about missing Rodri. Well, Rodri's okay. He ain't not pair, though. He ain't even close. So, yeah, I can imagine somebody having that space now. And the pitches, of course, obviously, are now, as you said, like billiard tables. And it would be amazing, wouldn't it? Well, it was amazing. And, you know, there again, it would be amazing today, wouldn't it?
Without a shadow of a doubt. I mean, I think, you know, if Rodri's winning the Ballon d'Or, Pirlo would definitely be winning it at last.
Yeah, we're in a
row of wrongs.
Yeah, to use a cluffy phrase, I'm not sure he'd be the best in the world, but he'd certainly be the top one, wouldn't he? Okay, so that's a massive thanks to Dave for sharing his thoughts on Pirlo and his iconic status in football. Thanks for listening in, and catch us again on the next episode of LARP Podcast from These Football Times.
Many thanks for joining us today on The LARP, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.